Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. What a great day. This afternoon, I was on Coach Red Pill, the round table. What an amazing crowd there. It was good. I don't remember exactly how many people there were live. Was it 1,600 or 2,600? One of these two numbers that I've seen, because, of course, you can't watch the viewer count at all time when you're concentrating on the delivery. But it was great to be in front of a big crowd again. This is Warski Live Numbers, what Coach Red Pill is doing right now. And it's very well deserved, because his show is the only one that gives this kind of streamer experience to the Ukraine war from a personal perspective. And it's so courageous of him and so unique. We never had this in the history of human civilization. War coverage has always been controlled from the top, and basically from state agents and corporate interests dictating the pro-war stance of the media. So in a way, we are looking at a human situation that we've just never seen before. Even the independent creators of long ago, they would be aligned in some way. Where here we have Coach Red Pill, who's really just a regular guy. I mean, he's a special man in many ways, but he experiences it as a regular guy and for us, and he reports on this. Dan Simon says, great show on the round table with Gonzalo Lira. 2.6K. 2.6K live, that's a Warski Live number. That's what we use to do on a regular show on Warski Live. So this is, it's the new center of attraction, this round table. And I'm so happy that it turns out to be one of my personal friends who's heading that. Ali Mer says, will you be joining the exclusive Tim Pool VIP social club at the 5,000 per year level, JF? I understand there will be plenty of opportunities to network with big wigs like Jack Murphy. Oh my God. You are tempting me. Can I get a private session with Jack Murphy? I mean, given Jack Murphy's sexual preference as a cuck, that might mean sex for me. I mean, if I find myself in a room with Jack Murphy and there's a woman, maybe I can have sex with the woman and Jack Murphy can just look. I know that's what he enjoys. No, but seriously, if I had a chance to talk ever to Jack Murphy, my question to him would be, how does it feel and why? How does it feel to be the guy who went on a Tim Pool show while the entire crowd of the regular chat was asking, we need, he wasn't on the show, but he was probably in the crowd. That's my suspicion. He was watching the show, and everyone was expecting Tim Pool to answer the Jack Murphy question, and he never did. And Jack Murphy himself never showed up to answer to the scandals developing around him and around his fake persona. How does it feel? That would be my question to him. How does it feel to be a man of the internet, but who couldn't face the internet when his persona came to be exposed? Because I don't know this. All I know is honest engagement with the regular chat. I don't know ignoring the regular chat. I don't do this. I don't know, you know, driving forward while ignoring a legitimate critique from the regular chat. But he knows. And that's what I would like to know. How does it feel to betray the internet? Go away, says Tim, won't address the Jack Murphy question. Exactly. Total silence. I don't think he ever did. Colin Oxworth says, pay 10K and he'll do a stream wearing only the beanie. Wow. I don't know if you guys are tempting me with options that I didn't want to have. Someone was asking if I'm French. I am a Quebecois, so yes, I'm French, but not French from France. I am a French Canadian, as they called us a long time ago, and as we called ourselves. So absolutely fantastic, this roundtable with Glenn Diazon, I didn't know the guy much, but I did some research just before the show. And he seems to be a great guy. He seems to have a head on his shoulders. He's an academic who seems to have a certain, somewhat dissenting view on the Russia question. Quite interesting to hear his thought. Dino Rogovic says, save your money, Jeff. Yes, I was thinking about that because today I didn't pay much attention to the news. I was driving to Civilization all day because I wanted to go get a snowplower. I went to buy a snowplower, which will because I've been shoveling snow with a shovel for 3 years now that we're here in the North Pole, and I wanted to have a more expeditive mean to push the snow away. So I bought an electric snow thrower, and I had to drive to get it. So I have no idea what's happening in the news. And a quick review as I came back home, there wasn't much happening. So I wanted to talk to you guys about what this blue check mark means on my Twitter account, because it means a lot of things to me. And it reminds me of my whole career on the internet and the persecution that people like me have been going through in the last 3-4 years. We had our businesses and our families destroyed. And to me, and it was largely destroyed by the very same people who started giving away those blue check marks as a social status symbol, completely violating the rules of the free market and I would say the unwritten rules of the internet. And it's a vengeance that I fully enjoy and that I think I'll keep enjoying up to the end of my life, to just wear this blood-stained blue check mark, blood-stained by the attacks that have been made onto liberty by these leftists who took over the executive branch of tech, of big tech, in the last few years and used it to advance their intelligence-related concerns and political preferences of all kind, and to advance the control of the deep state onto the internet. So it's not a light thing to me. People were telling me, Jeff, anyone can get that check mark for $10. I understand. And it's not the uniqueness of the check mark that I'm interested in. To the contrary, it's that people can get it for $10, whereas it used to be a very corrupt bunch who were distributing these check marks as a way to manipulate the public space, as a way to determine who's the winner. And the check mark doesn't come only with just the display. That's a big lie of Twitter. It came with protection from the exact type of banning that has been targeting me and so many others like Keith Woods, Millennial Woes. The blue check marks had more loose. They wouldn't ban a blue check mark account for spam. They wouldn't look for excuses to ban them. It was like a label that said, don't touch me. And it was the creation of a separate class of citizens on the internet. And it all came to an end with Elon Musk, and I will wear it to show those elitists who attempted to take over the free market and manipulate it in their direction that they'll never succeed at it again. We're just beginning. We're just beginning the reconquest of the internet, and it begins now. And it's such a special moment to be alive. Go away, says JF. In 1943, Rose Parks sat at the front of a bus. In 2023, JF adorned the blue check mark. Funny how history repeats. Absolutely. Except that Rose Parks was just fighting for some public bus discrimination of some kind. I'm defending the internet and freedom on the internet. So much more important in my view. Amalgam Zero says, I'm still banned. Yes, there is still much work to be done, and I'm not giving up. Every 5 days, every 7 days, I don't know exactly the frequency, but I will be reposting my list of demands to Elon Musk on Twitter. There's already 5 of the accounts that I've posted about that have been liberated. So if you want to get on my list, you just send me an email. send me a DM on Discord, whatever you have. I will add you to the list. I've added several people that I didn't know, but that people were telling me, hey, Jeff, this was my account. Could you add me to the list? And I will not consider that freedom has been fully achieved back onto Twitter, as long as every single account, and I will not consider that the general amnesty has been given until every single account that I list is restored. That's the least of things. You know, a general amnesty normally would mean all accounts. Now, I'm willing to play the game here and say, okay, I'm going to gather the list of accounts for you. But they better be unbanned because they were all banned on the same circumstances as me, all on the basis of lies, all while they were trying to replace us with regime-aligned thinkers that would control what the internet would receive rather than a free market of demand and offer. And that is a very bad thing. That is a dramatic thing that has been done to the internet. And I was thinking about this all the way home in the car. It dates for so long, this fight that I've been leading. And I don't even know if my own audience knows just how much I respect the internet. And the people who hurt the internet, I hate them with a passion. Deadstar says, I'm waiting patiently to see how far Twitter spreads JF's message. These next few months could be quite wild when it comes to new corners of the internet being met with based intellectual resistance. I mean, it started already today. Today, I had a little discussion about Hitler, and people were... The thing is, here's what happened. It starts with a post of someone who was saying this, okay? Hitler being a pedo is not discussed enough, in my opinion. Virtually everyone he dated was a teenager. Eva Braun was 17 years old. Jelly Robal was also around 17. Maria Reiter was around 16 as well. All known sexual relationships Hitler had started with teenagers whilst he was in his 30s and even 40s. It shows a particular type of masculinity expressing itself. Everyone has met a Hitler, that weird dude who is 35 yet hits on 17 years old. And I take so much issue. I take so much issue with this because there's a double speak here from the left. On the one hand, they want you to be open to pedophilia. Okay, you have to understand that pedophilia is a disorder, they will say. You have to understand that it's natural for a child to be attracted to sex. So they don't take issue with pedophilia. If anything, they're trying to push it in a little further. And yet they have this malaise with the regular and civilly legal and perfectly fine ID that a young female of 16, 18, 20 years old has a liberty in our society, the liberty to pursue our own reproductive strategy, our own evolutionary interest. And they want to, on the one hand, they're trying to tell you that sex with a 7-year-old is okay, but that somehow sex with a 14 to 18-year-old or 20-year-old is not okay, and she cannot consent. I've been targeted by this kind of stuff. They kidnapped one of my fiancé. She was 19, and then they started writing smear articles in the media about me as if having sex with a 19-year-old is a crime, when it's not. And when, in fact, she still consents and has always maintained that it was fine, that she was engaging consensually with me. I take major issue with these people who are trying to present the fucking with young adult women as pedophilia. It's not. It's young women pursuing their true interest, which sometimes may be to date a slightly older male or even a very old male, because they can assess the quality of the male because he's already been through his waves of success and failures. In many ways, for information gathering at the sexual evolutionary level, one of the best strategies for information gathering is to, rather than run the risk of a non-run test, if you take a 20-year-old male, you don't know if he's going to end up rich or not rich, or intelligent and or not intelligent, or is his creativity going to hit a roadblock, and will he be able to find a place in society. You take a lot of risk with a 20-year-old guy. You take much less risk with a guy who's already been through it all and who still has the same sperm that he had 20 years ago and can still inseminate just as well, and also with a proven track record of success. So I'm not saying that every single young female should date older men. I'm saying it's a legitimate evolutionary strategy, and you guys have been making the rules that make it legal for these women to date whoever they want because they're adult women. So let them be. So my point was, even if Hitler did this today, it still wouldn't be legal, nor pedophilia. The age of consent is 16 in many US states and 14 in Germany. It's a bizarre fight that the left is headed for, to be denying sexual freedom to young women, but it's in line with their rabid anti-natalism. When you try to figure out what's the logic behind trying to advocate for pedophilia at 7 years old, and yet call fucking with a 19-year-old or an 18-year-old pedophilia, it's very clear what the left is after. They are after natalism. They are anti-natalist. They don't take issue with you being sexual toward young kids because they know it won't lead to a baby. And they are sexual libertarians. And they're kind of sick in the head to a certain extent. I'm talking about the leftist here. On the other hand, if men start dating younger females of 19, 20, 18 years old, they get babies. And they get babies that will populate the world with a more conservative outlook and a family-based outlook, which is totally contradictory to the left's attempt at destroying the family. That's why they can reconcile calling someone a pedo for dating a consenting adult woman and yet not calling someone a pedo who fucks a 7-year-old. It's disgusting. Anyways, so yes, there is. I'm bringing back some degree of intellectualism on Twitter, and you can already see the reactions. Some people were like, defending Hitler to own the left. This guy was like, wow, he's defending Hitler to own the left. I retweeted him because it's not really what it is, but the left needs to think about this issue very seriously. And it should be a societal issue. And I think it could become a societal issue, particularly around the case of Britney Spears being the most prominent case like this, where an adult female is denied liberty because she pursues her own legitimate evolutionary choices, which may not make sense to you as her father, but still, the law sets a date at which you don't have to care about what the father thinks anymore, and the woman should be free to make her decisions. But bizarrely, we have this whole system that went after Britney Spears, which says, and they went after my fiance too, which says, if you're free to make any decision you want, but if you don't make the ones we like, we're going to go after you and deny your liberty. It's absolutely scandalous. So anyways, what does this blue check mark mean to me? Because I believe yesterday in the night, or maybe today, I don't exactly remember when, but in any case, probably during the night, I've been obtaining my blue check mark. There it is, and it says verified account. This account is verified because it's subscribed to Twitter Blue. What it means to me is it goes back to 1994, 1995, where I had my... Earlier than this, maybe the beginning of the 90s, maybe 1991. I was about 7, 8, 9 years old. So I was somewhere around those lines, 8 years old, and I had my first contact with a computer. It was an Apple II computer, and this computer was just standing at the back of my new classroom because I was in elementary school. I don't exactly remember which grade, but there was this computer standing at the back of the class, and I was relatively fast at doing my work, so typically the first to finish on any work in my whole class. And eventually I made it a habit to go start the computer. Go start the computer when I'm done, while the rest of the class is finishing up. And I discovered a world, a virtual world that opened to me. And eventually I became so fascinated by this. Yes, John Drake, Apple II was a very old computer, even by the standard of 1991. But somehow it's a computer that the school had acquired a long time ago. And somehow they had kept it there. No one had ever turned on this computer, probably for years, when I turned it on. And so I opened it, and eventually I became so fascinated by this computer that I started asking the teacher, can I stay in the class? While the kids go play outside, because the kids playing outside, they would yell. I wouldn't say I was the victim of massive bullying, but of course, every kid gets annoyed by other kids. There's this whole social status thing building at this age. And yes, I mean, to a certain extent, I didn't feel into the social world that they were building, and they were yelling, doing all sorts of chaotic stuff, running at each other. And I was like, I was already feeling like an adult at 8, 9 year old, was looking at them, and I was like, I would rather spend my time inside on the computer. So when you turned on this computer, there was nothing happening. There was no windows. There was not even dust on this. What was happening is a cursor would appear, and you would load a programming language. It would be GW Basic, and it was the only thing that was operating on this computer. GW Basic was appearing, and you had to program your own thing. And if I remember, there wasn't even a way to save the programs you were programming. You had to type them in. Maybe it's just that I didn't know the save option, but there may have been not even a hard drive in this computer. Vadat says there was a ROM with BASIC. Okay, maybe there was, but you know, as a kid, I didn't have a BASIC guide. I didn't know how to save. So what we were doing is every time we were booting the computer, we were rewriting a program. And the program, we started trying to guess what we could type by using the Alt key. And if you pressed Alt P, the print command would show up. And so we kind of had a guide through, okay, let's try each of the keys, Alt T, Alt R, Alt F. And we so there were no hard drives, but disk and cassette drives. Yeah, that's probably what it was. And we didn't have disks, you know. We were kids. So by the shortcut keys, we found out, okay, there's a print command. It allows you to print something on screen. There's a for loop. We eventually learned how to use these terms. And we started designing programs. I was accompanied by a friend of mine who was also kind of geeky, but not as intelligent as me. His name was Jonathan, and we were staying out inside in the during the recreation period, and we discovered the computer world just like this. And it was years before a computer even made it to my home. because this was somewhere around 1991, a couple of years had to pass before I got to high school. And eventually my parents had a 486. That was the name of the computer, 4086. And a 4086 was the computer preceding the Pentium. When the Pentium 5 came out, this was a big step forward in computational power. We had the computer at some point that was just below the Pentium 5, and it was a 4086, basically 32 bits style of computer. If I'm correct, that's what the 86 means, right? 86 meant the 32-bit platform, but MeToo says 16 bits. Maybe it was, maybe it was. I started being introduced to DOS-only computers then, and suddenly DOS-only computers were full-fledged computers that had hard drives. You could play games, you could install games from large floppy disks and eventually small floppy disks. I remember that the big large floppy disks were around 600 KB of size. And then eventually we moved on to the solid disks of 1.44 megabytes. Extremely small programs would fit on there. And I would play and I would write and I would use softwares of all kind. Back then it was extremely rudimentary. But I really enjoyed the computer world. It was a world that was responsive, and I think it was so much less chaotic than the social world outside of kids balancing themselves, playing, throwing themselves down slides and hurting themselves and crying and yelling. The computer world was just perfect. It was you were giving a set of commands and it would respond honestly and as ordered. People are asking about Philosoraptor says 486 DX or SX. I don't remember. The one computer that I remember, its feet starts being around Pentium 5. Now Pentium 5 was fascinating. A fascinating era of the internet. But anyway, so back then it was games and it was using of software. And I slowly got introduced when we got our Pentium 5. And let's read the other super chat. Doubting Thomas was saying, Jeff, regarding the excess deaths and cardio side effects of the COVID vaccine, we shouldn't forget the long-term cardio effects of catching the virus, especially if COVID is here to stay. Is it possible that getting COVID every 2 or 3 years for life will be like getting yearly vaccines? Well, yes, we have to account for these things in one way or another if we're going to make a final statement on what's better for a given individual, vaccine or COVID. But I would note that the way you phrase it, there's already a bunch of false assumptions in the way you phrase it. First, you assume that the new vaccines will systematically be fine to block the effect of having COVID. And you seem to be assuming that the vaccine kind of stops infection, when in fact, we don't know that the vaccine protects you even from the long-term cardiac effects of COVID. All we know is statistically perhaps less hospitalization, less death at the old age moment, but that is kind of a biased statistics in and of itself. Because if the vaccine has already killed the weak, of course the people who remain alive will be less likely to die. That doesn't mean that the vaccine saved these people, see? It may mean that the vaccine has killed the weak, and therefore, everyone who's left alive is ready to handle the virus. I find it so regrettable that we don't take this kind of statistics into account. The self-selective effect of vaccine survival could fool us into interpreting a positive vaccine effect. So, yes, what you say is true and important, but there's so many bad ways of going about it. And in a way, framed in the way you do, I wouldn't do it that way, because you are assuming that the vaccine effects will be cumulative over all vaccines, that the vaccines of the future will always be as efficient as the vaccines of the present. And you're also assuming that the vaccines of the present are efficient at all at blocking a COVID infection and its effect on the heart, when it's not clear to me at all. So much to do, and yet no one doing these things seriously, so there's no one we can trust. Dino Logovich says, Jeff, I looked up the meaning of sacre bleu, but surprise, surprise, the internet is wrong. It comes from the dyes used in stained glass for churches and cathedrals in times long ago. Okay, I had no idea. Sacre bleu is just a very it's not an expression that is used. It's used comedically sometimes. I believe there was a cartoon in Quebec or in France that was using that term. But yeah, it's something that you use comedically. You are always ironic in your use of it. Nicolas Petris says, Jeff, do you maintain that you don't hesitate to call it a vaccine? I mean, when I say vaccine to point to the vaccine of COVID, it's just because they call it that way. And I don't care that much about labels. Now, we can get into the philosophy of what is a vaccine, what is not a vaccine, and it's all going to be arbitrary, the dividing lines that people try to push toward their side. So I'm not super interested in a semantic debate, which is why I obfuscate it. I won't tell you, oh, it's not a vaccine. But I get what people mean when they say this. And there's a legitimate question about what is a vaccine. Is it what we've traditionally done as vaccines, or is it any future technology that we use with the hope of getting immune? I mean, it's open questions, but it's all semantics. Silver Spider says, I remember my first exposure to computers was around age 10. A friend's dad had an early computer with DOS and floppy disks. I don't know what it was, but he worked in the Navy as some kind of computer programmer. Oh yeah, Mama JF reminds me of who it is that was using Sacre Bleu, Captain Haddock. is it in Popeye? The Captain Haddock, is it one of the persons in Popeye? But anyways, yeah, he was using the term Sacre Bleu comedically. Purple Tuna says, I need a vaccine against poor streaming quality. Well, you are the only one complaining, Purple Tuna, and normally when the streaming quality is low, a lot of people will come in the chat. Oh, Captain Haddock is in Tintin. Yeah, Tintin, not Popeye. I should know, I've read all of the Tintin when I was a child, but I guess I forget all of it. I was just like, I need to read all of the Tintin. I didn't find it fascinating that much. I was just a freaking artist trying to accomplish the full collection. Yeah, other people are reporting that the stream is good. So Purple Tuna, stop complaining for problems that you are experiencing on your side. You are sending me a link. Go away. CPS investigating Rockwall Eat workout that led to hospitalizations. Parents of Rockwall Eat football players speak out about hospitalizations. A workout has led football players to be hospitalized. Okay, well, 400 push-ups and had to allegedly start over whenever someone stopped. Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of sports is if you want to be any competitive, you're going to have to be pushed. And if you're being pushed, there's going to have to be risks and effects. So I don't know what we do with this. Do we say sports is worth it and it's worth the deaths and everything? I don't know. Personally, I'm not a sports guy, as you may have guessed from my geek story on computers. But I say if some people want to do competitive sports, they should simply accept the risks that come with it. And it's like, okay, if your coach doesn't push you to do your 400 push-ups, you're going to be a mediocre sportsman. You're going to be a mediocre athlete. So what do you want? It's like Michael Jackson. Would he have been a great dancer if he hadn't been beaten up by his father? No. So what do you do with this? Do we want great dancers or do we want a child beaten? As a libertarian, it's always been my position that it's not worth it, and that the development of a natural human, not super skilled, not super specialized in something, was enough for me. And I don't think we should push ourselves to the point of threatening our own health and happiness. All right, so continuing my story with computers, eventually the Pentium 5 comes out. I don't remember, was it 133 megahertz? 133 megahertz? What was the frequency of the Pentium 5? I think it was something like this. And yeah, one something in the megahertz scale. And we had one at home, and I start discovering BBSs, built-in board systems. We were connecting to these things using a modem, the 14400 baud modem that we had. 1.3 gigahertz, you say? John Drake says I had a P2 and it was 450. Yeah, I think it was in the hundreds of megahertz scale. So yes, Crazy Catman says my 486 was 33 megahertz. Yeah, so it makes sense that the Pentium 5 would be around 133. And so I discovered the built-in board systems and I immediately loved those. You could get files, you could message, and there was a whole virtual world with aesthetics and the fonts were being used and the colors of the letters were being modified. Every BBS had its own personality, and you had to call to a phone number to connect to a BBS. So you connected to the computer of someone else, and this was the central hoster of the BBS, and you left a message on there, and eventually someone else connected to the BBS and would receive the message or look at the updates on the forums and stuff like this. And I was just fascinated by this, so much so that I started my own BBS. I don't know what years it was, probably between 94 and 97, because 97 is when the internet was regularized in Quebec and became available. But before this, it was BBSs. And yes, me too mentions the 56K baud. That was eventually I updated to a 56K baud. But the 14.4K had been a massive one for a lot of people. A lot of people, that's all they could have at some point in history. Vadet says, I used to play Legend of the Red Dragon on the BBS. Oh my God, that was an intense game. I loved it. There was a bar, there was an inn, there were fights with monsters, and all of it was happening in text. It was all text. It was like a monster attacks you. You have that many hit points. Here it is. And oh my God, that was fascinating. It was an entire world, and I've spent so much time on this. I started hosting my own BBS. Wasn't a big BBS, but in the locality, it was enjoyable to have a center around Sainte-Sophie where people could connect. And I think I did that BBS setup I must have been between 11 and 13 years old, approximately, perhaps over 2-3 years. And eventually I asked my parents, can we have a separate phone line for that BBS? Because you had to leave your computer occupying the phone line for your users to be able to connect. And so I asked my parents, and they were generous enough to pay me a separate phone line that they would pay every month to have a separate phone number. And that was wonderful, because then my BBS was open for 24 hours a day, and I was interacting with people. One of the advantages of being... Yeah, Valet says Renegade BBS. Yes, Renegade BBS was the software. That was there was either Renegade BBS or PC Board, and that was the two big software that were already prepared to host the BBS. And I had a Renegade BBS, if I remember correctly. And one day, I remember totally shocking my father, because I had decided that this was my first super chat. Like, my first super chat was in maybe 1996 or something like this. I was 11 years old, and I had set up that BBS, and eventually I decided to start a subscription program. And it's like, okay, if you pay, you're gonna have priority access and whatever. I don't even remember what I was giving out, but you would have file access, and you could do more stuff on the BBS. And one person subscribed out of, I don't know how many people there were, maybe 30 people on the BBS, loosely connecting sometimes, one time and another. And one person decided to support me and decided to pay me $10 to buy the high class on the server. And I told him my address. When you think about it, it was dangerous to do this for a kid. But I told him my address, and eventually, coming back from school, I went under the bricks in the front of the house, and there was a cassette. You know, these tape cassettes on which music used to be recorded? There was an empty cassette box with $10 slipped in it. And $10 for a young child like me, this was the biggest amount of money I ever held in my hands up to then. And back then it was meaningful. I think it may have been half of the cost of the phone line every month. And so I had my $10 right there, and my father saw this, and he was like, I couldn't believe it. He was talking to me years after this. It was like, I couldn't believe that my kid had made a manifestation into reality from his virtual world. He was fascinated that somehow money had come out of the computer. And so my father was the first person to really drag my attention to the extraordinary nature of the super chat in 1996. And when you look at what my life became later, like 20 years later, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable that this interaction leading to $10 stemming out of the computer world had shocked my father, and that I hadn't realized the power of it all as much as he did. But he couldn't believe that, because for him, you go to work, you do some soldering, you do work, and then money comes. But to him, the whole computer world was a world of fantasy, and he understood that I was very fascinated by this fantasy, but to him, nothing could come out of it. And yet something had come out, $10. And that was my $10. Even if I should have given it to my parents, because they were paying much more than $10 to keep my phone line and to pay for the computer. But they were happy to leave it to me. And I was therefore starting to accumulate money through various means. Back then, we were teenagers. We were driving in bicycles around town, and we were gathering the beer bottles around the bar and the cans of Pepsi Cola dropped here and there, and we were bringing them to the grocery store or the convenience store, and they would give us money in exchange so that there was a refund, you know, 5 cents per can and 10 cents per bottle. So we were very happy when we were finding beer bottles. One summer, we did about $120 of cans and bottles gathering. $120 in a time that was massive amount of money. Eventually, that was enough to buy a modem with a higher speed. So in any case, this was my introduction to the virtual world and even to the idea of super chats. And I knew that there was a massive power sleeping onto the internet. And eventually, we entered the tech bubble, and I continued my interaction with the internet. Well, eventually, I discovered the internet. And at first, my first interaction with the internet was, okay, a couple of web pages, AOL, and that kind of Yahoo, that kind of early websites. And eventually, I found the Euclidean scripts on the internet, and it allowed me to, very early in my teen years, maybe not even teen years, maybe 11, I don't know. But I had access, thanks to the internet, to the Euclid elements, which allowed me to develop my knowledge of mathematics, geometry, one of the big interactions that I had with the internet very early was MIRC. And so I was hanging out on hashtag Saint Jerome, hashtag Montreal, hashtag Saint Sophie, and there were, you know, if you were an operator of a channel, you had the alpha at the beginning of your name, which is not so different from the blue check mark. You know, in a way, it was a symbol of status and control over a MIRC channel. But at first, I was shocked by the speed of the internet and how everything was available to everyone. And to me, it was radically different from the BBS world. And I was very nostalgic for a moment on the internet. And I was like, why are people headed toward this crap where a dozen people can ask you your ASL? You know, ASL meant age, sex, location. So there were times I answered to ASL, you know, 12, male, Saint Sophie. That was my ASL, and then eventually 14 and 17. But I eventually went over that nostalgia and just accepted that the internet was superior. And the big tech bubble, the tech bubble, started growing, and everyone was interested at how do we recruit the energy of the internet to make money. And this was the time of websites developing, Amazon appearing. It was all very interesting to me, but it hadn't become a way of living. Although I spent most of my time on the internet, it wasn't my job. It wasn't, I wasn't a streamer, I wasn't anything. In fact, there were no streams. All there was is HTML programming, MIRC channels, and piracy. Those were the activities you would do on the internet. And HTML, of course, visiting. And eventually PHP and that kind of stuff. So I knew the power of the internet. But at the same time, there was waves of economic interest showing up. And they were making these very clumsy websites. Even Amazon itself, to a certain extent, was kind of clumsy from the beginning. It was clumsy, it was painful. To me, the HTML world wasn't fully developed, and it wasn't as easy to use as today. And yes, Valet points to ICQ. ICQ was really a first of its kind social media. Maybe there were precedents, but to have this little messenger-style window on the side of your computer that was telling you, this friend is online, this friend is offline, hey, add me to your ICQ so we can speak anytime. That was totally revolutionary, and I had a ICQ. I can't believe that somehow the internet is so competitive that eventually that kind of thing disappears and better things show up. Usenet News Group, Chi Chi Ping says, yes, Usenet News Group was another thing. Unfortunately, I didn't have access to this. Maybe it was too technical for me to know about it. I don't think that the internet subscriptions in Quebec came with this. So it was really a separate world to me that I never quite had access to. But it was massive because a lot of the piracy was going on there first. You know, the, as they called it back in the day, zero-day wars. I've never really understood how the Z works in this. Do we say wars? Do we say wars? Do we say wares? Anyways, a lot of it was circulating through these fake forum posts on Usenet that was basically not fake, but in the sense that it was using Usenet to pass on a file. And there were central servers that were holding all these files and distributing it to people. Crazy cat. End of the line. Joel says it rhymes with cares. Cares wears. Oh my god. So that's how you guys said it. I mean, as a Frenchman faced with only the written world and having never had a normie in my life tell me how to pronounce wears, I was saying wares. I was thinking in my head wares. Juarez. Let's get some Juarez. And Frog Eyes says, lead speak days. Yes, the lead speak days were great. So my interaction and my love of the internet dates to these days. And so what are the next steps in the evolution? Well, I became fascinated with emulation, ROMs, learned programming, did a lot of programming, a lot of projects that never culminated into something produced, but I was learning a lot and I was doing a lot of programming. And I mean, the next big events of the internet were, to me, was the whole rise of Web 2.0. The social web, a web that was becoming more complex and that was becoming higher bandwidth up to the point where YouTube could rise. And eventually, as part of YouTube, Wikipedia, eventually platforms that were social in nature, things that were collectively contributed like Wikipedia. And everything was starting on the internet to look like a collective work. And I was so amazed at this. And I was still kind of a leftist, although I've always been very libertarian, very anarchist, and everyone does what they want to do. But there was something very charming to my young mind, who was still living on the memes of leftism. There was something very charming at the idea that a collective work was happening, and it was the creation of the Web 2.0, the birth of Wikipedia, and all possibilities for human knowledge to become free. There were parallel movements of Creative Commons license dominating Wikipedia, piracy totally ruining the world of the music industry and the movie industry. And to me, this was always the same fascination that my father had expressed, that which hadn't stunned me at the beginning, but as I saw these events, I was like, all right, the real world is getting impacted by the virtual world, and that is a lot of power, that is a lot of changes. People are mentioning Fortran. Yeah, I never was. I encountered Fortran because my uncle was a programmer. And at his home, I think he had a Fortran operation of some kind. And Fortran, Pascal, that kind of language. But those are not things that I've become expert of. John Drex mentions Napster. Yeah, Napster. Napster, LimeWire, all the rise of these P2P techniques that were pre-torrent, I would consider them. Barnabé Buto says, I said it the same way, JF. Juarez. All my friends did too. Maybe it's a Frenchy thing. I mean, for the French mind, there's no other way to pronounce Juarez. But I've always known that the English, you know, the way they treat S's and Z at the end of a word is very different. So be it. But it's so interesting because in my head, it's said Juarez always. So, yeah, the Napster and the internet was just owning the real world. It used to be that the music industry was just a dominant and super nepotistic domain where basically you had the radios of the 90s determining this is a big hit, and there was large amount of money, and there was large amount of money being transferred at the level of purchasing of tape cassettes and eventually CDs. And the internet world was just rolling a tank over all this and saying, no, you know, the economy will change because you won't become a millionaire anymore by being just a star. Or if that still exists today, but it's getting rarer, you know. Yeah, you have to tolerate a lower salary if you want to be a music star, or even if you want to operate a Hollywood movie within budget. I mean, it's getting hard for these companies. And all of this was an accomplishment of the internet. And it led to me, it was the beginning of a revolution in how the top would not control anymore. That the internet would determine what succeeds, what doesn't succeed. And that there would be a fair playing field. That there would be no way to corrupt the radio network to play your tune, because there would be no radio network that would survive, and there would be no CD store that would determine whose CD they will sell. All of these nepotistic deals would fall under the strength of piracy. And I was enjoying what I was seeing. And in parallel, I was doing my studies in biology. And I was discovering all of the cellular biology stuff, evolutionary biology, and rising toward the university. And I was basically a silent observer of the internet growth and fascinated by the impact on the economy, which I understood very early what would happen, that the systems of nepotism and central control would disappear and they would be replaced by something better. But I can't say that until 2012, 2013, that I've been satisfied by what it was replaced with. I was seeing Amazon rise, but I hadn't fully appreciated Amazon yet as a destroyer of brick-and-mortar bookstores. I was seeing piracy, but Hollywood was still very strong and the music industry was still nepotistic. So I wasn't really satisfied, and I knew that we hadn't reached the end of it, that we hadn't reached the end of the change that would happen to the world. And I think that YouTube is this, the rise of YouTube, and particularly the rise of political commenting, and initially a lot of atheistic and secularist commenting, I believe that this set a satisfaction in my head. I was satisfied that we were about to reach the end of the accomplishment of the internet. Mama JF is here. What's up, Mama JF?
Hello.
Meanwhile, Mama JF was a sperm in the testicles of her father. Yeah. What's up?
Yes, my friend in high school was saying the meme instead of meme.
The meme? Oh yeah, it's so horrible how the Quebecois now call them mem.
Really?
And it makes me cringe.
Back then we didn't know there was no audio stuff.
Yes.
Like now you can go on Google, say pronounce it.
Right? Yeah, and now there's YouTube also, so you get to hear it by people.
We don't
but
know.
Back then it was all text.
We didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
We have been misguided.
All right, MemJF. And there was a Canadian guy who was ridiculed, wasn't he, for using mem ridiculously by Atheism is Unstoppable. Anyway, around 2012, and this wasn't, I don't believe that YouTube started in 2012, but around 2012 when you know the Drunken Peasants podcast was at its peak and there was communities building and there was independent creators supporting through Patreon. To me, the systems had been set in place that the final revolution of the internet would come. And that it was not only sufficient to destroy the real world, we had to replace it with something better. And it started being around the YouTube golden days that I started feeling that the better was here and that we had accomplished, we had made our way, and we had reached what we wanted to reach. Speaker's Corner says, you missed 2003 to 2010. That was an interesting period. I mean, I'm not obfuscating it. Wikipedia was great, and that's why I mentioned all these things. But to me, a very critical moment was the great rise of YouTube as a place that would basically compete with the numbers of the mainstream media. That was when I started realizing that Drunken Peasants have just as much audience as certain Fox News show or certain CNN shows. And then I felt it. I felt the call. Now, I didn't know back then in 2000, I guess in 2013, I started appearing on the Drunken Peasants. And I had been watching the Drunken Peasants for many years. And I was disappointed by the intellectual level. I knew that there was more potential than this, but that they were kind of the sewers of the internet, the first life form to rise, that they would eventually be replaced by something better. And in a way, they were benefiting from being the first, from, you know, being in this whole anti-feminist, early anti-SJW kind of crew. And there wasn't much on YouTube back then. So if you wanted to watch political videos, you had Sargon, Drunken Peasants, and maybe 20, 30 other creators. But that was pretty much it. So we had to watch these things. They were the only things available for the thinking man, in a way. So I was consuming Drunken Peasants, and at the same time knowing that I could do better. And so the first thing I did around 2013, 2014, and at this point I was in my postdoc at Duke in North Carolina. And I remember being in those small apartments where I had only, you know, I had only a mattress laying on the floor and then a sink. And my apartments were relatively big, but they were filled with nothing, just empty space. And and because I didn't care about my home life, I was working at Duke as a postdoc doing brain research on monkeys. And I was, in parallel, very interested in the developments of the internet world. And around 2013, I started paying the Drunken Peasants, paying their Patreon, donating to their Patreon. And there was a level at which you could appear on the show. And eventually I switched to that level and decided to make an appearance. And it was my first public appearance on the internet in video. Back then I had already a Twitter account started with a lot of followers. I'm looking at my Twitter account. I started it in March 2011. So in March 2011, about 1 year or a little 1 year and a few months after Twitter was founded, I joined Twitter and I had gathered a considerable amount of followers already because I was talking about neuroscience and bringing attention towards scientific subjects of all kind. And I don't know, maybe I had even released a couple of YouTube videos, just short clips of thoughts, not political very much, but, you know, looking at optical illusions and brain knowledge of some kind. I don't remember exactly if I had any of these videos up by the time I was going on Drunken Peasants. But my idea going on Drunken Peasants, as I saw the IRL world crumble, the nepotism crumble, and the virtual world rise at the same time, my idea was that there would be some opportunity for me to promote my book, which I hadn't written yet, and I would only write 3 years later, start to really seriously write 3 years later, and publish 5 years later. So I started promoting my book on Drunken Peasants 5 years before it came out, The Revolutionary Phenotype. And I just wanted to perform well going on Drunken Peasants to build an internet persona that would be associated with quality commentary. And I think I delivered. I think I delivered a lot of entertaining and thoughtful analysis on Drunken Peasants. And I was kind of showing the world, here's what it could be. It could be something else than a bunch of drunken liberals just scratching their balls on the screen. Some of the highlights of this era, of course, the rap against G-Man, where I totally destroyed him with the massive rap that I had written. Then, other than this, it was just general libertarian kind of leftist commentary, although I've never been a statist leftist. I've been kind of a libertarian, enjoying the themes of the left, like care for harm. And I had kind of a philosophical setup in my brain, introduced perhaps by all of these years of brainwashing and school. I had kind of a libertarian prior inside my heart, and then a care for well-being and harm because I was a leftist like everyone else who has been through that kind of brainwash. DK Shadow says, your debate with Doc's Holiday about all types video and website was great. Jeff Holiday, but that was much later, right? I debated Jeff Holiday probably in the days where TJ was not even a host of Drunken Peasants anymore. But when I think of the golden days of my appearances on Drunken Peasants, it's really when TJ was there, where even Paul Zigo was not there yet. Paul Zigo eventually came in later. There's always been something weird with Paul Zigo. There's always been an elevation of a man who probably has lots of issues inside of him, you know. I've always thought that he didn't quite fit there, that he didn't quite have the open mind of TJ that was a kind of trademark of the Drunken Peasants, and that he was a performer to some extent. He was a people pleaser, sometimes delivering good commentary, but always in an interested, and it was kind of, you could see in Paul Zigo kind of perhaps the beginning of bread tubing to a certain extent, the beginning of the corporate production of language that pleases the crowd, but that doesn't quite engages with the truth. Colorado says, the left made sense when I was poor. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of what it is. DK Shadow says, TJ has gone full people pleaser mode. Yeah, I mean, TJ has his own history. Anyways, those were great days, and it was so great also because this is my training. What I was interested in was to develop an interaction with the audience, was to experience the live streaming against a great crowd and the interaction with the regular chat. And even if you go back to 2013, I'm sure that if you would pull these episodes, I'm reading the regular chat. Maybe sometimes I'm even mentioning some of the things that people say. Because to me, it's always been about this. It's always been about, can you feel the crowd better than other people? Because it's very easy to just sit in front of the camera and record as you would if you were offline. But to me, there was a new technology rising. It was live streaming. And it hadn't been properly and fully exploited. And so I started exploiting it in the best way I could. Eventually built my Drunken Peasant's appearance to build my channel. And started live streaming myself, the kind of shows that eventually built into the KrautNT stuff. And that allowed me to measure the power of the internet and the fact that there was no one that could get at me. That all I needed was a Twitter account to keep a connection to my audience, and that there was no arbiter that would say, we don't sell JF CDs. We don't sell JF books. To me, all I needed was the internet and its fairness. And this Twitter account meant a lot in this strategy because it was the only thing that was making the bridge between the world of credibility and the social world and the world of freedom, and you win because you produce something of quality. I was never interested in the world of credibility, but I knew that it was a necessary leverage, that people had to believe that you were credible. And I will tell you how 99% of the people do, even in academia. They look right here. And if you are above 1,000 followers, you're someone. And if you're below 1,000 followers, you're no one. That is just how it works, and that's a reality. People look at your social media following and they think that you're someone suddenly. And they think that, oh, I should know about him. He's got 34,000 followers. That is just how it is. And in all fields, that is how it is. In all fields that are related to the internet or to prestige of any kind or authority, that's how it works. Kentar says, these days you can lose your credibility in a day by saying the wrong thing. Well, what I appreciated about this phase of my life is that we were truly free and there was no way to get at us. The people wanted to listen to what we had to say, and we had the platforms to say what we want to say. And there was no one to interfere. There was no algorithm that was biased by Susan. There was no Twitter bannings. That was a beautiful moment of the internet, probably the moment where I've accrued the most power, to the point of scaring our elites, really, to the point of having our elites intervene and stop this state of affair. So when I tell you that this blue check mark means something to me, it was precisely this slide between 2015 to 2019, where we started with freedom. And yes, David Smith says, back then YouTube promoted JF. YouTube promoted anything that you would watch. And so if people were interested in JF, and if I was scoring well on audience metrics on my review of Kraut, YouTube didn't give a shit. They would send you to me because the algorithm knew that you wanted to watch the whole thing. That's how it worked. And I won this algorithm. I built a YouTube channel of 50,000 subscribers, maybe even 60k at the end. I build a secondary channel of 18k, and then I build the JFG Tonight smaller eventually because of the shadow banning and the manipulations of the algorithm. But we were untouchable and we were freaking scary for a lot of people, which is why this era of the internet is when you see an article like the Daily Beast come out about me. It's like, why do you care what a random Frenchman on the internet does in his sex life? Oh, I fucked a 19-year-old girl. What are you going to do about it? It's not even illegal. She never even said that she was disappointed. But these articles come out because people start saying we're going to need to throw money at journalists to go after these guys and take them down. This is what happened. You know, given all the revelations of the Twitter file and the link with George Soros-based institute that we're trying to control which tweet gets deleted, which tweet survives. I would like to have a Twitter files of the Daily Beast article. I would like to know what's the tunnel of money here. Because it's not random that I start accruing power, influence, and I start talking about George Soros, and a couple of weeks later, these articles come out. And I was starting to be alarming to certain people because I was talking about race and I was bringing attentions to the bullshits of Kraut and all these people. And I was rising on Warsky Live here. And Warsky Live was a whole era also that was interesting in terms of liberty was starting to be oppressed there, but not fully. Warsky Live was benefiting from the last moments of the FAIR algorithm and built audiences that rose to eventually a show where 12,000 people were watching live. 12,000 people were there at the moment Richard Spencer clashed with Sargon of Akkad. So to me, it was such a beauty that this would rise instead of the mainstream media that we had destroyed a decade earlier through piracy. It was so beautiful to see this power accruing in random hands that would do random things with it. And I knew that something positive would come out of it. But in the era between 2015 and 2019, there was a progressive arrival of the normieplex, basically, onto the internet that we had built. And these people were recognizable by a little golden star that was put on their Twitter account, where it was denied to people like me. And I would constantly look at their bio on Twitter, and they would have this blue check mark. And right here, I joined March 2011, I would not see this on their account. I would see joined March 2015, joined 2016, joined 2017. I was there 5 years before them. Sometimes I had 30 times their follower count. And yet, they had some networks of agents that were in relationship with the Twitter staff, and they had some deal with their journal, their newspaper that they were working for, and they had been given the label of being official people, and they were given this blue check mark as a means to eliminate people like me, because the rules would not apply to them, but they would apply to me. And in fact, more than the rules, they were at this point, they were inventing rules to come at us. So the blue check mark became a tool of the regime to try to take over a force that they had underestimated, the force of internet anarchy and internet chaos, which I had come to master enough that not only would I make the $10 that my dad was so impressed about, but I would make a living out of it. And I would be able to eventually leave academia and leave it with no fear, knowing that there was something that would catch me on this internet world. And there was various things. There were various things that helped me. I did contract work for a while I was building my YouTube channel. I was doing translations, writing for people, and I was making a good living just to survive while my career was rising. But eventually, Twitter wasn't content with giving this label of approval from the regime. Twitter decided to ban people on false grounds, as we've seen revealed in the Twitter file. And in December 2021, they targeted my account. After banning all of my friends, all of the people who had been speaking for racial identity or who had been somehow involved in the idea of racial identity and discussions of identity and nationalism in general. They were all targeted, and eventually I was targeted too. And I was deprived of the tool that it is to have an official positioning on Twitter, which unfortunately it's like this, but it's unfortunate that it's like this, but your follower count on Twitter gives you credibility, and the fact that you're on Twitter tells people that you exist at all. And when you get banned from Twitter, as I got banned in December 2021, after talking, covering lots of news items, racial subjects, criminality, programming, censorship, social media stuff, and eventually COVID, I was banned on false grounds. And it was very frustrating to have this email that says that I've committed spam when I clearly haven't. And now we know why I committed spam. We know that this is the excuse that the one team in Twitter had decided that they were overriding the decisions not to ban of other teams. And they were like, oh, they didn't catch him for hate speech, but I can catch him for this. And they were making up stuff. Some random bloke says, black and Jewish identitarians were fine, JF. It was only white identitarians that got banned. Well, I know this. When I say people who talked about identity, I'm talking about a very specific type of identity. I get it. And so, yeah, and I was extremely hurt because it was my living. It was my living to be present on the internet and to look at the world at a higher resolution than pretty much what you could get most places else. I mean, I tried to deliver the most intelligent outlook and the most open outlook on a certain set of political subjects and scientific subjects, and I think I had been successful up to then. But without my Twitter account, it was very, very hard, very hard. And I knew that this was all a fake system. I knew that, a little bit like when I was looking at the children in elementary school staying inside, I knew that I was working on something real on the computer, and that these kids yelling at each other and bullying each other, I knew that they were not sustainable, that they were bullshitting themselves into a fictitious story. And I knew that the Twitter people were bullshitting themselves into a fictitious story. You cannot maintain a standing as a trustable company, especially not on the internet, if your work is to fuck people up who trusted you and who built you. I built Twitter. Twitter became what it is because of people like me joining it early, not because of the others joining it 5 years later. And I had the conviction that either Twitter would fall totally or that it would be saved by someone like Elon. To be honest, the perspective that it would be saved was a wild dream. And what we have seen in the last few days, well, for me, but in the last few months for a lot of people, is that the wildest dream is coming to be true. And that some of the excitement that I had about the internet has been reawakened by Elon. And I think Elon is looking for the same thing as me here. I think he's looking for an internet in which things are not controlled, but things emerge out of their own qualities. and arguments are addressed for their own validity, rather than have a controlled discourse by a bunch of psyop-trained state agents and corporate agents who are willing to pay for silencing. This is what the blue check mark means to me, that I'd rather pay for speaking than let someone pay to silence me. And so I highly encourage each of you, if you have money, if you have extra money, go buy a Twitter blue subscription. We have to show the world that when Elon trusts the internet, that the internet will reward Elon and anyone else who trusts the internet with money. And it's very important to me that Elon receive positive signals from his actions. So I would absolutely recommend, if you have extra money, go spend it on Twitter and buy a Twitter blue subscription. For $10 a month, which you probably spend more on your phone line, probably spend more on restaurants, you probably spend more on pretty much anything you buy. I say $10 because it's 10 Canadian dollar, but if you're in the US, it's actually $8. This is a minimal amount that can allow us to build a constant revenue stream for Elon to ensure the liberty of the internet, which is so important. It's so important that it comes back. And I already feel it coming back in the last few days. And as I interact with people on Twitter, this blue check mark to me, and this will be my conclusion for tonight. I hope you enjoyed my story. This blue check mark is a mark of war. It's a cut in the liver because my enemies used to wear it. And they used to be proud about denying it to me. They used to use it as a way to dismiss my scientific theory, which is valid, and which, by the way, for those people who think the scientific theory will go away because you ignore it, it won't. So address the revolutionary phenotype. You guys are losing your time and you're ridiculing yourself, because history will look back at those who have ignored knowledge when it was available. But this blue check mark to me wins the victory of the other side, the victory of those who were first oppressed, but who came back and restored the internet as it should be, the internet that I've known and that has led to my rise. That is the internet I want to see again. Let's look at the super chat. Philosoraptor says, I remember my first live chat experience on a BBS with 6 lines. It was so exciting. Chatting live with strangers, I was shaking. Yeah, man. Those BBSs that had multiple lines, that was fascinating. You could have many people at the same time on them. That was stunning. Philosoraptor, it was the first time you could interact and feel the humanity in the letters typing themselves progressively, you know? He says, if you paid, there was no ratio for downloading games and porn. Well, there was no porn on my BBS. See, I was a very early conservative of the internet world. Even before the internet, I was banning porn. Shrigmamel says, Jeff, I've talked to my girlfriend about the internet of the early 2000s. I feel like an internet boomer compared to her. Yeah, it is always stunning to be courting a younger woman. They are from another generation, another world. But with Mama JF, I feel still, even if she's younger than me, she's pretty based. You know, she's been hearing about me on 4chan first. So I feel that I have a similar connection to the internet as she does, which is great. Doubting Thomas says, I wasn't considering that the vaccine was effective, just that both the vaccine and the virus are to be avoided for long-term effects. Regarding China, they did last month lift their no-COVID policy, and the number of infections did explode there. That's why there is so much fear baiting of it. Okay, so you're explaining to the super chatter of the last show, I guess, who was wondering why there's a second wave of media coverage of China fears. Maybe this explains it. To me, tracking these infections from a mediatic perspective has always been a big joke. It's always been playing in the hands of, I mean, I've been covering it to counter the narrative. But primarily, the fact that somehow society decided to focus on viral infection counts in 2020 out of nowhere it was playing their hand of making it more scary than it really is, and most importantly, kind of denying death and trying to not accept death. There's something implicit in all this COVID fear porn. It is that death must be fought at all costs, and that we can save people. We can't. We're all gonna die. Dino Legovic says, Jeff, I looked up the meaning. Okay, this one I had read earlier. Go Away had sent me this Fox investigation, which I've consulted. Okay, so I've read all of the super chats. Well, thank you so much for being here with me for this review of my history with the computer world. I stand proud today, and I will pay Elon $10 a month for the rest of my life. I don't care. I just want to throw money at him. In fact, I'm thinking about promoting one of my tweets, not because I care about a particular tweet that I'd like to promote, but I realize you can send money to Elon. Like, if I click promote my tweet, I can move the cursor and maybe send $200, $500 to Elon. I won't care at all about the promotion of the tweet, but I think I'm going to do it just to shower Elon with money. Because you have to be a fanatic to enjoy that Elon is taking us through the dream here. And he's thrown a lot of money on this. So much money that it's symbolic at this point. I mean, $44 billion, it's completely insane. It's certainly not the value of Twitter as it stands. Twitter is a urinator of money. It's pissing money out. It's losing money constantly. And so it cannot possibly be worth the acquisition rationally. But Elon did it as a signal. He did it as I'm willing to burn that money for free speech. And I'm willing to burn my own money for free speech too. And I'm burning it by sending it to Elon so that he can burn it. Bye-bye. Thank you.